Please join me in welcoming Danny M., our main speaker tonight.
Hi, everybody. I'm Danny Marsh. I'm an alcoholic. I want to thank Lee for asking me to come up and do this. I had never met Lee before, and depending on how I do, I may never meet him again. So we're just going to see what happens in the next 45 minutes. I want to thank Carolina for a great 10-minute talk. Oh, my God. If you're new to alcoholics, you heard everything you needed to hear. Like, you heard what it was like, what happened, what it's like now, and that story of hope and redemption and change that can take place as a result of working the steps. And oh my God, I just loved her talk. And I really, really, really want to thank Billy for the fudge. It's worth the drive up. I have a sobriety date. It's April 24th, 1990. I have a home group. It's the Tuesday Night Solution Group meeting. We meet on Zoom. We used to meet in person. And COVID hit, and now we meet on Zoom. And I have a sponsor. He's a little garden gnome in Jerusalem, Israel, named Yisrael C. He knows he's my sponsor. We talk regularly. And I'm right where I belong, which is in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you're new, I'm sure you're thrilled for me. If you're new and you're sweating heroin out of your spinal fluid, I'm sure you're going, oh, but I'm really happy for the Jew at the podium. Really, I am. Because when I was new and I heard you guys were having a good time, my hope was that you would get hit by a bus after the meeting. Because I came here dying of alcoholism. I came here absolutely dying. And if you're new and you hear nothing else from me tonight, hear this, you're safe. We need nothing from you. You don't gotta do jack around here. My prayer for you is that you try not to have a drink tonight and come back and hang out with us again tomorrow. And if you drink tonight, come back and hang out with us again tomorrow. Because I don't get surprised when we drink, I get surprised when we don't drink. Like, I could not stop drinking when I got here. So when I got sober in West Hollywood, and there was a guy there named Bill Burns, and he used to say, if you don't tell us how you're really doing, we can't really help you. So I'm just gonna tell you how I'm really doing. I'm 36 years sober, and I'm struggling a bit. I've got some health stuff going on that's really scary. And the way I'm hardwired is that I then become obsessed. I have a little prayer in the morning, which is, dear God, you handle the medical stuff and let me know what I need to know, when I need to know it, and what I need to do and when I need to do it, and the rest of it just carry away. Because it'll sit in my head all day long, it'll color my day, it'll get in the way of any decision I make. So I've got all the, so February of 2020, I was in Las Vegas and I was uncomfortable. Like, my chest was tight and my jaw was clenched and I didn't know what to do. And so I came home and I was still feeling uncomfortable, and I got on my knees and I said, Pop, am I gonna be okay? And a little voice came into my head. It was the voice of my gay Cuban AA brother Vincent. And the voice said, I got you, boo. So that's how God talks to me. I got you, boo. So I knew I was going to be okay. So I went to bed. I woke up the next morning and I was still uncomfortable. I thought I might call my doctor. So I called my doctor and he said, and I quote, get to the freaking hospital right now. Here's what I heard. Take a shower, shave. Pack a bag, and maybe have a little breakfast. And then make your way over to the hospital, where I was experiencing something called sustained ventricular tachycardia, which the cardiologists frown on. So they shot up my chest with a whole bunch of stuff. I ended up in coronary care, and they told me I needed a device implanted in my chest, a pacemaker and defibrillator, to keep me alive. So we had the procedure. I got out of the procedure. I went into a coma for 3 days. And then my life changed. But here's what's really cool. Well, it's not really cool. But I was sponsoring a new guy at the time. He had 30 days. And when I woke up out of the coma, he said, he was sitting in the hospital room, and he said, thank you. And I said, I'm a little confused, thank you for what? He said, well, while you were out, John Graff called, and Lisa called, and John Irvin called, and I knew that I was taken care of, so thank you for texting them and having them call me. And I said, dude, I was in a coma. Like, I was not texting behind your back. And he had that look. He had that look in his eyes that he knew in that moment that he was safe and protected in the arms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you're new, my prayer, and granted, that's an extreme 12-step call, and I like to say he's tachycardia worthy, but not coma worthy. And he's still sober today. And so if you're new, my prayer for you is to stick around until you know. Until you know, because we will care for you as long as you need it to be cared for. And so I've got all this health stuff going on, and it keeps going. And I've learned, my friend Eileen Waterstone says, I got sober to follow directions. So I follow directions, and I pay attention to what the doctors do. And so they told me that what I needed to take was an oral chemotherapy. And that freaked me out. It scared me to death. I was worried about losing my hair. And seriously? Nice. Nice group. So I was freaking out about the side effects of the chemotherapy and what was going to happen. And I called my sponsor at the time, and I said, what do I do? How do I navigate this? I'm really scared. And he said, I want you to do a meditation on the chemotherapy. I want you... So my first thought was, you want me to do what? He said, I want you to do a meditation. So my thought was, get a new sponsor immediately, because this can't be helpful to me. Like, I need concrete action. And he said, you know, so every Sunday night for the last 6 years, I sit in a chair and I invite God in and I thank him from the bottom of my heart that he's created a medication that may save my life. And I invite it in to do its job, and then I invite it out when it's done doing its job. And I've done it for 5 minutes every Sunday night for 6 years, and it changed me, right? It changed me. And so I'm still got all this. So I take a boatload of medication, and I hate the way it affects me. I leave out the part that it's keeping me alive. I leave out that part because it affects my mental acuity, and it affects my, I get a little brain fog, and I have trouble sleeping, you know, just stuff like that. And I struggle with it. And thank God you taught me how to do an inventory. Thank God you taught me how to put this on paper. Thank God you taught me that it's okay to be resentful at this power greater than myself that saved my freaking life. But that's okay because I got alcoholism. And you've prescribed for me a perfect treatment for my alcoholism. So I'm struggling with all this stuff, and I was in Washington, D.C. a couple weeks ago to watch my daughter graduate with a master's degree in education. Talk about a lame dad. Talk about a proud dad. And we were sitting with some friends one night at dinner, and this young woman who I know really, really well at dinner pulled out a newcomer chip. And I was so excited for her. She said she had 10 days. And I said, oh my God, that's so cool. What about weed? And she said, okay, I got 2 days. I said, whatever, babe, whatever, whatever. She said, I walked into a women's meeting all by myself, scared to death. I sat down. A woman came up to me, asked me if I was new, handed me a big book, said, here, you should have this. Invited her for coffee after the meeting. This girl went. She got on a phone list. She developed a gratitude list. She got a sponsor. She was immediately enveloped by the power of Alcoholics Anonymous. And when my friends say, why are you driving up to Arroyo Grande to talk? Because I may be that hand to the new guy. I never want to not be in my sober spot when there's someone out there who could be helped. And I know by me doing this, that woman was in the meeting in D.C. to help that young woman. And so I just keep doing this. And but so I called this woman up 2 weeks ago and said, so how's it going? I had promised her that I wouldn't cross the line, that I wouldn't get involved with her sobriety, that I would keep my distance and allow me to be a safe place for her to come. I lied. I bald-faced lied. So I called her about a week after and I said, so how's it going? Are you going to meetings? And she said, yeah. I said, how many days do you have? And she said, I don't know. I'm not near a calendar. And I'm like, oh, I know what that means. We all know what that means. And then she said, and you know what? You crossed the line. You promised me you wouldn't do that, and you thoroughly lied to me. And I was crestfallen, and all I could say was, you know what? You're right. I'm sorry. You're right. I care. I love you. I want only for the best for you, and I will do my best to not do it again. And ever since then, our relationship has been a little bit distant, a little estranged, and a little uncomfortable, and I don't know how to repair it. And so I'm living in that discomfort and sitting with that discomfort, and it's really hard. And it's really hard. And again, you guys taught me that the real gift of sobriety is learning how to live comfortably in unresolved situations. So I can have this discomfort going on, and I can have this health stuff going on, and I can still get up and do prayer and meditation and go to work and sponsor guys and allow myself to be sponsored and drive wherever I'm asked to drive. And none of that will be changed as a result of what I'm experiencing in my life. And boy, I did not anticipate starting this talk so heavy. Normally I talk about freebasing with sex workers. It's a lot easier entree into a talk than like laying all that on you, so I apologize. I grew up, my grandfather was a rabbi in Hollywood, and his dream for his grandson was to follow the calling. And if he knew where I was talking about freebasing with sex workers, he may have wanted something a little different. So I grew up in the San Fernando Valley. That didn't cause my alcoholism. It introduced me to snorting mini cross whites, but it didn't cause my... I talk a lot about drugs, and I'm sorry if the talk about drugs offends anybody. I get confused a lot, right? We don't talk about drugs. Drugs are an outside issue. We do talk about... I talk about drugs. I hope it doesn't offend people. It offended everyone in my life for a really long time. And then I read Bill's story, and on the seventh page of Bill's story, he goes to a doctor, and the doctor gives him a sedative, and the next day finds Bill taking both gin and sedative. And in Dr. Bob's story, he talks about taking pills in the morning to calm his jitters so he could make it through the day without having a drink, so he could go home and start drinking again. And I thought if drugs were good enough for our founders, they were good enough for me. And giddy up, I did boatloads. I said my grandfather was a rabbi, and I grew up in the valley. I come from a really, you know, what I love so much about Alcoholics Anonymous is that everybody comes from a different place. What some people experience in their childhood is not what everybody experiences. I came from a really loving household. I had a mom and a dad and a baby brother and was gifted with a baby sister and was afforded every opportunity a kid could have growing up. And I never felt a part of. And I never felt equal to. And I never had the skill set that you had, so there was no way for me to get from where I was to where you were. It was impossible. And on the morning of my bar mitzvah, my grandfather had invited 1,800 congregants to watch the prodigal grandson become a man, I discovered vodka. I discovered vodka, and the sense of ease and comfort produced by that first drink changed the game. It changed the game. So I drank all morning. I was drunk at my bar mitzvah. I threw up on the pulpit. I almost didn't make it through the Torah ceremony. I embarrassed my grandmother and my grandfather and the 1,800 people who came to support me. Then we had a party at my house that night, and I drank and I threw up and I drank and I threw up. And this is how I treat people. Everybody had my back. Everybody wanted to see me succeed. Everybody wanted to love me. And I will kill you to get to the drink. Nothing stands between me and my medicine. And I will kill you to get there. And I woke up the next morning, and a normal person would have thought, oh my God, what did I do? I cannot do that again. I thought, oh my God, I cannot wait to do this again. And giddy up, it was off. I mean, I drank like that out of the gate, and then I got introduced to pot. I hated pot, hated it. I smoked it every day for a decade, hated every minute of it. Like I felt like a little puppy on linoleum, you know, like I was really busy, but I never went anywhere. But I was busy. And then I got introduced to cocaine, and I should have known that was a problem. And this could date me a little bit, but I got fronted a dime bag, and you laughing are my age. Thank you very much, appreciate it. And you younger have no clue what a dime bag is, and you missed out. So I got fronted a dime bag. I did it all in a line. I refused to pay the dealer. We got in a fight in the quad at high school. A buddy of mine put him in the trash can, and that was my introduction to cocaine. And a normal person would have said, this could be trouble. I thought, I need more. I gotta get more. And on my high school graduation weekend, my buddy Artie Simon called and said, let's go to my parents' house in Lake Arrowhead, you and I, and celebrate graduation. We'll each bring an eight ball and we'll celebrate. So I did mine on the drive up. And then I spent the weekend helping him find his. And then he called me a year later and said, dude, it's our 1 year anniversary. Let's go back to the cabin. I still have some of that blow left. And I thought, oh my God, you are a sick man. You are, because I had stolen thousands of dollars from my grandmother's wallet in that 1 year period of time to get my medicine. And I didn't understand how he did it. And I was so filled with self-delusion that I believed I was the normal one. And so I drank like that, I did drugs like that, I did all kinds of crazy stuff. And when I was 18 years old, I had gone for the afternoon, I had come home to find out that my little brother had died in a mountain climbing accident. And 3 weeks later, I was taking a walk with my dad at Valley College, and he dropped dead of a heart attack. And it sucked, right? It ripped out every shred of safety and security and comfort and understanding that I had had as a kid growing up. And I went to the rabbi at the time and I said, what do I do? How do I reconcile this? And he said, I shake my fist at God. And I said, that is not enough. There is no connective tissue there. There is nothing that will give me comfort there. So I crawled back into a bottle of Jack Daniels. By that point, I had developed a drink. It was Jack Daniels and peppermint schnapps on the rocks. Seriously? How many ceiling tiles did you smoke? You know? You're like shooting dope off dirty toilet seats and judging my cocktail? Like, I freaking love Alcoholics Anonymous. I get sober and virginal all of the, ew, how could you do, really? Where are you guys coming from? I love AA. I absolutely love it. So I drank like that, you know, and I crawled back into a bottle of Jack, and I can tell you standing here today that although those experiences helped shape the guy that's standing in front of you, they had, you want to get that? Although those experiences helped shape the guy that I am, it had zero to do with my alcoholism. It had zero, because if those experiences caused my alcoholism, I could go to therapy and freebase like a normal guy. But I am bodily and mentally different from my fellows, which means that once I put something in my system, I cannot predict within an hour, a month, a year, a lifetime, if I'm going to be given the gift of stoppage, if I'm going to be given the gift. So I end up in a little apartment in Toluca Lake, and I had a grandpa who was a Russian immigrant. He came to this country with nothing, zero. 18-year-old kid escaping Russia, didn't know the language, didn't have a skill set, went to school, learned the language, developed a career, built a better life for his kids and his grandkids than the one he had been given. And I was too loaded to go to the hospital the night he had a heart attack. I was almost too loaded to make it to the funeral. But when they were handing out those little checks, I was first in line. Because that's the guy I became. And I like to date by the hour. So I put the money in the bank. And I called an escort service. And she brought a freebase pipe. And she stayed for 6 months. And I don't know about the rest of you men in this room, but my first thought when I ingest freebase cocaine is long-term Neanderthal sexual relations. Unfortunately, the last thing that's humanly possible is for me to be an active participant. So if you can picture the short, fat, mulleted Jew waddling around his apartment with his underwear around his ankles, chasing a sex worker for 6 months, getting absolutely nowhere. Like, and I hadn't heard the term pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. I thought they were normal dating rituals, right? And thank God I got to AA, where a lot of you guys had the same experience. But my buddies who were like in law school and med school, they weren't doing that. And what happened for me is my grandpa spent his entire life building a better life for me, and I smoked it up with a sex worker in 6 months. So if you're new to Alcoholics Anonymous, I want to welcome you. I don't know what that black hole of shame is that you're hanging on to. I don't know what that cancer of the soul is that you're unwilling to separate yourself from. But I was going to die from shame before I died from alcoholism. And I was taking that to the grave with me. And I ended up in a little apartment in West Hollywood with a buddy of mine. And I got asked to leave that apartment by the U.S. Marshals because I found out they're a terrific moving service. They packed my bags, threw my stuff out on the street. The landlord wanted rent. I had none. So ended up in a little apartment in West Hollywood. One night I was doubled over in a whole bunch of pain. I went to Cedars emergency room. They gave me a shot of Demerol. They said, whatever you do, do not drink. And I'm like, huh. By that point, I was drinking 2/5 of thrifty Blue Brand vodka out of the bottle every night. I would wake up in the morning, I'd brush my tongue, I'd throw up the bile from the night before, I'd crawl back into bed, I would drink whatever I saved so that I could get a hit in the morning. I would turn on a Highway to Heaven rerun and then see where my day went from there. Like, I used all my sick days by January 3rd. They gave me a shot of Demerol and they said, you need to make an appointment tomorrow with a gastroenterologist. And here's how deluded I was from alcoholism. I believe I played by a different set of rules than anybody else on the planet. And I'm an incredible opportunist. Don't you know what I've been through? If you've been through what I've been through, you do what I do. And I was convinced that he would not find alcohol in my system. And he drew the blood and he came back and he said, do you drink? And I said, yes, sir, I have a glass of wine a night like anybody else. And he said, it's noon, you have a 0.25 blood alcohol level. I said, all right, I'm a 2-glass guy. He said, you also have an incredibly distended liver, and I'd like to check you into the hospital to detoxify your liver. And as they checked me into the hospital, the detox from alcohol was too hard for my heart to handle, so I had an atrial fibrillation of my heart, and I ended up in coronary care for 3 days. And then they suggested that I was a candidate for the chemical dependency unit, whatever that was. I had no idea. I didn't know what AA was. I didn't know what rehab was. I knew nothing about it. But they were giving me Ativan, and I was willing to follow them anywhere for another Ativan. So they said, so they checked me into this facility, and then they said, we're going to a place called the Log Cabin. And I thought, cool, pancakes. Like, I can do Alcoholics Anonymous. So you got to understand, at the time, I was the same height that I am. I weighed 245 pounds. I had the San Fernando Valley crystal meth speed drummer's mullet. I had a huge bushy beard. I forgot to tell you that they asked me to play volleyball in Ativan, so I broke my ankle in two places. I put on my best shirt, which was a purple and gold striped shirt, and gold MC Hammer harem pants. And they put me in a wheelchair, and they wheeled me down Beverly Boulevard and up Robertson Avenue at 7 o'clock in the morning. How you guys knew I was a newcomer, I have no idea. But you were really kind, keep coming back, keep coming back. And all I could think of was leave me alone. Like, I'm dying here. And I went back to the unit that night, and I wrote in a little notebook, went to my first meeting ever of Alcoholics Anonymous today, filled with people a whole lot sicker than I am. Because don't you know? And then second line was, went to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous today, filled with a room filled with people a whole lot more willing to get well than I am. And in that moment, I knew Alcoholics Anonymous couldn't work for me. One more time, I couldn't get from where I was to where you were. And I did 30 days in that hospital, and I'm a model patient because I'm incredibly manipulative, and I know exactly what to tell you to get you off my back. And we had a coining ceremony, and we passed around a coin, and I got in my car, and I went to a liquor store, and I bought 2/5 of vodka, and I went home, and I started drinking again. And it talks about me really specifically in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. The difference between the heavy drinker and the alcoholic is the heavy drinker, given sufficient reason to stop, stops. I had a distended liver and atrial fibrillation of my heart. I was told if I drink, I'm going to die, and I cannot stop drinking. I cannot replace that cycle of spree and remorse with the cycle of surrender and commitment left to my own devices no matter what. And on April 23rd, 1990, I was standing on the front porch of my house with a half-drunk bottle of vodka in an overnight bag, waiting for my mom and baby sister to take me back to the hospital. And that look of pain and fear and terror and disgust and sadness and remorse and confusion that I saw in their eyes in that moment, I haven't had to see in anyone's eyes in over 36 years. So when Lee says, can you come out and talk? You bet your ass I can. Because I got two actions today in my life. I'm walking towards a drink or away from a drink. And the more actions I take walking away from a drink, the greater the opportunity I have to live a life that I was absolutely ill-equipped to live when I got here. And what I know now that was absolutely impossible for me to know in that moment is that on April 23rd, 1990, I couldn't stop drinking. And on April 24th, 1990, the drink problem had been removed. Without any thought or effort on my part, it just had. And like I said, what I know now that I couldn't know then is that that was the beginning of the experience of the touch of the Master's hand. Because I couldn't do it left to my own devices. And I got busy in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I got a sponsor. He'd never worked a step. I'd never worked a step. We were perfect together. And I called him every morning and said, hi, Bob, it's Danny. And he said, hi, Danny, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. I love you. Call me tomorrow. And what he did is he made AA a safe place for me. Like, if he were punishing, no one could have been harder on me than I was on myself. And if you were going to tough love me into this deal, I'm out. I'm out. It can't work. You can't penetrate it. So he made AA safe, and then I got a sponsor, and we started working the steps. And when I got to the ninth step, I went to the cemetery to talk to my dad and my brother and my grandpa and try to make amends. And you told me for any of this to have any lasting effect, it must have depth and weight. Well, it had neither of those. And so it felt a little hollow, and I came back to you and I said, what do I do? And you said, just show up, do your job in Alcoholics Anonymous, you'll know. So I got sober in West Hollywood, and AIDS was really rampant. And people were dying right and left. And my sponsor Bob got sick with AIDS. And I used to go to the hospital every day and hold his hand, wipe his brow, kiss his cheek, do whatever I needed to do, and I didn't do it because I'm a good guy. I'm not a good guy. I'm a runner. I'm not a stayer. I'm a manipulator. I'm not a helper. And then when he died, I spoke at his funeral, and I sat down, and you know what? I was a little cleaner with my dad. And I was a little cleaner with my baby brother. So I just kept showing up doing my job in Alcoholics Anonymous. And as you can imagine, the mullet and the harem pants, not a lot of dating. I know it's shocking, but there was not a lot of action in my apartment. And I am a stalker by nature. My dating skills are stalking and snubbing. It's all I got. So I stalked this woman at my morning meeting. She was a hairdresser. I had a mullet. I thought we'd be perfect together. But I had never done a sexual inventory, so I had no clue how to ask anybody out. So I figured if I made a hair appointment in 1 hour of uninterrupted time, I could con her into going out with me. And I did, and we went out on a Monday night, and it was the perfect AA date. The stars were out, the moon was full, and I knew like 4 seconds into this date that she was mine forever. Because I am the jihad of dating. I don't date, I take you down. And we had the perfect date. She may not have even known my name, didn't matter, because I was done. And the next morning, it was before cell phones, so the next morning I put cards on her car, flowers on her doorstep, and I called, I don't know, 30 or 40 times to make sure she hadn't forgotten about me. And the next day I did the same thing. And the third day I did the same thing. And on the fourth day, she dumped me because I was freaking insane. Like, I was not dating material. And she went her way and I went my way, and we ended up going out again. We ended up moving in together. And right after we moved in together, she said, honey, I'm gonna go to Hawaii with my friend Tony. Here's what I heard. Honey, I'm gonna go to Hawaii and have sex with everybody in the state except you, you loser. And I freaked out and I called my sponsor du jour and I said, what do I do? He said, I'm gonna tell you exactly what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous. I thought, great, I need direction. I need direction. He said, you didn't get sober to be treated like that. I want you to march home and tell her she's got a choice. You or Hawaii. She can't have both. And if she chooses Hawaii, you pack her bags and you throw her ass out on the street. And I thought, it's a little harsh, but I want to be that good AA soldier and follow directions. So I marched home, thank God she was at work, thank God. And I opened the big book to page 69 where it says, now about sex. We all have sex problems, we'd hardly be human if we didn't. Counsel with others is often helpful, but we do not want to be the arbiter of anyone's sex conduct. And 7 pages prior to that in the book, it says, this is the how and why of it. First of all, we had to quit playing God, which tells me in those two passages that I don't have the right to take away you having the dignity of your own experience. I have one job, and that's to share with you my experience and trust that if I've got a power greater than myself that separated me from a drink, you've got a power greater than yourself that can guide your life as well. So I married her. We've been married 30 years. And I called a man named Scott Redman that I had heard talk in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I said, I need help. And he said, in the most delicious voice I've ever heard, honey, I can help you. And I knew he could. Really, today's the 18th anniversary of his passing. And I miss him daily because he changed my life. He invited me over to his house. We opened the big book to chapter 5. We read the third step prayer with one another. He didn't pray it at me. It wasn't a sponsor to a sponsee. It was one alcoholic holding hands with another, inviting God into the solution. And then he introduced me to the inventory process as it's outlined in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Resentment, fear, and sexual misconduct. The three areas of my life where alcoholism presents itself the most. Where if I treat it like a real piece of business right here at all times, I have an opportunity to grow and change in a way that I couldn't without that tool. Resentment's the number one offender. It has the power to actually kill. These resentments must be mastered, but how? I couldn't wish them away any more than I could alcohol. And my favorite, the wrongdoings of others, fancied or real. Which means it didn't have to happen, I just had to think it happened. And I have tremendous mind-reading skills. I can read your mind behind your back like nobody's business. And so I get resentful all the time, right? Because I got alcoholism. I don't get to pick and choose when resentment's gone. My responsibility is to treat them in Alcoholics Anonymous. So let's say I'm resentful at my wife, right? I know it's a stretch, but let's say I'm resentful at my wife. The cause, she said good morning. But I know what she meant. I know what she meant. She meant, you're a loser. When are you going to take care of this? Why haven't you done this? So I'm resentful of my wife because she said good morning, right? She did nothing, but I got alcoholism. What does it affect in me? It affects my self-esteem because I'm married beneath me. It affects... I wrote this inventory 2 weeks ago. I'm not making this up. It affects my pocketbook because I've wasted way too much money on this woman. It affects my ambition. It makes me want to be less of a good husband. It affects my personal relations because I'm willing to assassinate her character to anybody that will listen. And it affects my sex relations because I start withholding all of this from her, right? And all she said was good morning, but I got alcoholism. And you tell me what to do with that information, right? We disregard the other person entirely. The resentment's mine, not hers. What are my defects of character that if God were to remove, the resentment would be lifted? I'm punitive, I'm retaliatory, I'm grandiose, I'm judgmental, I'm manipulative, I'm a bully, I use silent scorn, I withhold, I'm sober longer than she is, and I do A much better than she does. So there could be a little spiritual pride and a little false pride and a little shame and a little self-pity. But all of a sudden, once I take a look at those defects of character, I have a place with which to start to engage this power greater than myself. And I firmly believe in the 6 and 7 step that if God's powerful enough to separate me from a drink, he's powerful enough to separate me from some grandiosity. And my responsibility is to then behave like a guy who's been relieved of it. And thank God I just get a daily reprieve. Thank God this doesn't last a lifetime. You know, and it tells me in our book that this work will last a lifetime. So I will never be, you know, I get was, and so, and then the fear part of the inventory and the sexual part of the inventory, it's the fulcrum for change in my life. It's once I see that blueprint of my alcoholism, then I know the causes and conditions. So I mentioned I've got this daughter, I went back to watch her graduate. When she was 17 years old, I came home one afternoon to find out that she and her best friend were out driving. Now my daughter had a permit, and her best friend at 17 just got her license. And I know that you can't drive with someone who just got their license. So I go from being the loving, kind, compassionate, caring, sweet, thoughtful father that I am to a representative of the California Highway Patrol, just like that. And she comes in and she says, I said, babe, where were you? She said, I was out driving. I said, how could you do that? You know you're not allowed to do that. You know it's irresponsible. You know you're gonna lose your permit. You know that you're gonna lose insurance. Why would you go out and do something like that? And what I failed to mention is that she was a nationally ranked debater and far smarter than I will ever be. So while I'm reading her the Riot Act, she's texting me 5 articles contrary to everything I had just said. So I looked at those articles and I looked at her, and I'm I don't know, 20 some odd years sober, and my knee-jerk reaction is, if you hurt me, I gotta hurt you more. And if you come at me, I'm coming at you harder. So I looked her in the eye and I said, babe, I'm so thoroughly disappointed in you. And she was crestfallen, like her dad's never spoken to her like that. And my wife jumps in and says, you know what, you can talk to her about anything, anytime, but you can't do that. That's not fair. So I thought about it, and I thought, one bullet will take them both out. One bullet will eliminate the problem. And then you told me what to do. You said pause when agitated and doubtful. So I said, Pop, who's the dad I'm supposed to be here? And I walked back inside and I said, babe, I'm so sorry. I'm scared. I've never been the father of a 17-year-old before. I've never been the father of someone learning how to drive. And I don't know how to do this. But I promise you, I will do everything in my power to never punish you for my fear again. And we will figure this out together. And that's the kind of household that you have shown me is possible. When Ruby, my daughter, was 7 or 8 years old, we had had this goldfish named Edie the goldfish. And Edie was with us Ruby's entire life. And I came home one afternoon to find out that Edie was belly up. And I had to tell my kid, because when I was growing up, we had a family pet. My mom didn't tell me he died for a decade. So I didn't want to be that dad. So I walked into Ruby's room and I said, Pumpkin, I got some really sad news. Edie's dead. And she said, that's so sad, Pop. I said, what do you think we should do? And she thought about it like an 8-year-old. And she said, you know, Pop, we should take her back to the ocean and release her back to her family. And I thought, oh my God, that's so sweet. But we live in the valley. And it's it's 8 o'clock at night. And I want to be a good dad, but not a great dad. I said, so can you come up with something else? And she, like a little kid, said, yeah, Pop, we can flush her down the toilet. Eventually, she'll end up in the ocean. And I thought, I love my kid. So Cindy grabs Ruby. I grab the fish. I plop her in the tank. And I say, babe, is there anything you want to say before we say goodnight, before we say goodbye? And she said, and I quote, dear God, thank you for allowing me to have Edie this long, Edie with our family this long. Now, please gently take her home to hers. And that's the power and the magic of Alcoholics Anonymous in my house. That's what you guys have brought. That's my sponsees and my sponsor, my wife's sponsees and her sponsor, and the kindness and the gentleness and the safety that you created a little kid, so for a kid that she can come up with a prayer like that and feel safe doing it. And I flash back to 18 years ago when Scott's dying of liver cancer in the hospital. And 10 years ago, and my mom's dying of heart failure. And I just mentioned it before, I'm not a stayer. I am a runner. I don't have the equipment to navigate these situations. And I'm holding Scott's hand, and I'm kissing his forehead, and I'm waiting for him to take his light into another room, and I'm scared to death. And the same thing with my mom, and the only thing that pops into my head is Ruby's prayer. Dear God, thank you for allowing me to have Scotty this long. Now please gently take him home. Dear God, thank you for allowing me to have a mom this long. Now please gently take her home. And what happens for me is if I don't treat my alcoholism like a real piece of business in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous, I miss the whole thing. And I'm unwilling to allow alcoholism to let me miss anything. So if you're new to Alcoholics Anonymous, I want to welcome you. I don't know what you're bringing to us. I don't know what you've got going on. But I promise you, if you treat your alcoholism in Alcoholics Anonymous, you don't have to miss anything ever. Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. Welcome home. Thanks.
Let's give him another round of applause.